folks. Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they try to make me go to rehab. I won't go.
Addiction is a big problem in the United States, but how does a 10-year-old kid become an addict? We know that children have to progress through certain developmental stages. They learn to crawl, then walk. They learn to trust or not to trust. And they learn if the world is a safe or dangerous place by the secure and loving presence of significant others. Derek Steele grew in stages too, but he learned a lot more than most kids his age. He drank alcohol at 8, smoked pot at 10, and was fully addicted to ecstasy, meth, and cocaine by 16. His book, Addict at 10, explores addiction, excess, and the long road to recovery. He's here today to tell his amazing story. His book is available through my website on the Amazon link under Heartline Podcast. Derek, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Yours is a compelling and inspiring story. Start us out by helping our listeners understand how a kid becomes an addict by age 10.
Well, there's a lot of factors that typically go into that. There's the big nature versus nurture conversation that regularly goes on. And I believe I'm, a bit of both. I think that physiologically I just respond differently to chemicals than other people. And B, on the nurture perspective, I grew up in a household where A, there was, no real nurture, and I was surrounded by people that drank and used chemicals, drugs. And so I really kind of got the double whammy. And then at the bottom of all this is the spiritual component. What I refer to as a spiritual malady or spiritual sickness, which is all throughout our home, and there really was no spiritual activities were Christian or church activities. I went to one church for a few minutes when I was growing up, and so there's just no spiritual foundation in combination with a very chaotic physical experience.
So where were your parents in all this? Were they checked out, and how did that affect you emotionally?
They were very checked out. I think on the surface, probably what they told themselves, and if you were looking from the outside in, which you may have seen, was that they were trying to provide us the quote-unquote good life. They both worked very hard, and we lived in a wealthy area or anything like that, but it was definitely upper middle class. We had all of the things that we needed and most of the things that we wanted, other than our parents' time, attention, and direction. And so they were very absorbed in their work lives. And they also had their own problems that, their own baggage that they brought with them, as parents based on their childhood. So very unavailable. And my sister and I really, in a lot of ways, raised ourselves.
Now, were your parents upper middle class? I mean, was your dad a successful businessman? Like, a lot of people have this idea that, oh, people that are in the druggy culture are just poor and live in ratty neighborhoods and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stereotypes based around, you know, race, socioeconomic status, so on and so forth, education, and they're all 100% completely false. yes, you know, I wouldn't call it wealthy, you know, we weren't flying around in private jets or anything, but we had a very nice large home and, you know, took ski vacations and Aspen or Vail, and, you know, I mean, we definitely had a fairly privileged upbringing, so there's definitely not a, you know, economic status, but in many ways, I will say that that actually can be very detrimental, because there's a price that you pay for financial success.
Mm-hmm.
There's a price that a family many times will have to pay, because, you know, money doesn't just grow on trees. Somebody's out there working very hard for it. Typically, you know, the harder you work, the more you get. So we paid a price for that as kids, that our parents were out pursuing the, you know, the American dream and so on and so forth. And it was a very lonely existence. And I was experiencing what I'll refer to as we talk as the spiritual malady. Long before I took my first drink at 8 years old, and long before I started doing drugs at 10. And the sensation of that was just feeling empty inside. And we all, you know, Christians understand that hole that's inside of it, that God-shaped hole. And I just felt very insecure. I felt different. I felt a lot of fear and anxiety as a kid, and I just didn't feel right. Something was wrong. And I exhibited behaviors that prior to drinking and drugs that were symptoms of that condition. So that's part of, you know, the component that this was going on inside of me. You know, people talk about drugs and alcohol being a symptom of the problem, and really are. So I was experiencing the problem and other symptoms other than chemicals before I ever took my first drink.
And so your parents didn't notice that? They didn't notice that maybe that you were an anxious child or that you were lonely? Nothing?
No, they were really not tuned in.
How about your sister? Were you close to your sister?
Very close. And she's 5 years older than me, and in many ways, she raised me.
Hmm.
I mean, she would cook us dinner many nights, and, you know, she took care of us. Like I said, I mean, they were really not around a lot.
Did you see them doing drugs or alcohol? I mean,
a lot of alcohol, but I didn't see them doing drugs until later on when I was in my teens, and we actually ended up doing drugs together. I knew that they did drugs at about the age of 10, and actually I got my first marijuana from my mother and my first cocaine from my father. Not directly, they didn't hand it to me, but I got into where they kept their drugs, and I took some. And so very early on, I knew that they did drugs. And, of course, alcohol was just an always-type thing. I mean, there was always alcohol in the house. There was always drinking. There was always parties, so on and so forth. So very early on, I got the message that, you know, alcohol is just a kind of a normal, common thing. But the message that I got that was really my interpretation and that it was inappropriate for me was that I saw everybody drinking and the centerpiece of the fellowship was the alcohol and feeling different, feeling like an outsider because of what I felt like. I very quickly put two and two together. Kids are very, very smart. I have kids and they amaze me at how smart they are and the conclusions that they draw. And so the conclusion that I drew was everybody's drinking, everybody's talking, everybody's having fun around these beverages. Maybe if I participate, then I can be a part of that.
Yeah, so you felt a sense of belonging then.
Absolutely. Now, I had no idea when I drank the first time at 8 years old that I was going to get drunk. I didn't understand that component of the beverages that were the centerpiece of the, you know, fellowship. which I figured out. But really, I just wanted to do like everybody else was doing. I just wanted to kind of fit in, if you will.
So you were your parents around then? I remember you saying that you were at a dinner or something, and you were having a margarita and ended up passing out. Were your parents with you?
Yes. Well, the Friday night routine was that my parents and a bunch of their friends would go to a Mexican food restaurant, and everybody would drink, and, you know, they would do their drinking routine, and, of course, the kids would be there, and we'd all be doing whatever we're doing, running around, so on and so forth. And so I just kept taking sips off of my parents' drinks. And, you know, it wasn't their intention to get me drunk or anything like that. I mean, they're not malicious people, so as I refer to my parents, I don't, you know, have any animosity toward them at all. And so they're just a part of my story. But, yes, I was continuing to sip it. You know, you're 8 years old, I'm probably 70 pounds. It doesn't take very many sips off of strong margaritas before I ended up face first in my plate of food. And so,
Did they get that?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of comical. So they didn't really, I would be so taken aback if that happened with my, I mean, it wouldn't happen with my children, but, you know, I that would just be so disturbing to me. But in this environment, with their mentality, it was actually, you know, humorous that had occurred. So that's just the environment that it was.
So how did it progress from there? So here you are, 8 years old, you're trashed for the first time, and then, you know, you said at 10, did you keep drinking?
So I didn't drink again for a while. I was closer to the, like, 9 kind of area when I drank again. And I didn't really get the message at that point as to the effect that alcohol had. So I hadn't really understood the effect. So then there was a big party, and we, you know, we had a champagne fountain, you know, where you put your glass in and it just spills over and all that. It was a big party my parents were having. And so my sister and her friends were all sneaking glasses of champagne. And so she's 5 years older, so, you know, she was 13, 14, and, you know, that's who I was hanging out with, which is another fact that hanging out with older children is not appropriate either. But so that's who I was hanging out with, and they were drinking. And so I was, you know, joining in with them. And I ended up getting drunk then. I don't remember a lot of it. My sisters told me about it, but they basically just put me to bed. Nobody really knew about it except for she and I and some of the other kids that were with us. Didn't really get it then either. You know, I was just, once again, just kind of peer pressure type deal. Then shortly after that, I initiated it, and I stole some Everclear from my dad's liquor cabinet and mixed it with Pepsi. And then me and some of my buddies, once again, older kids there in the neighborhood, drank it, you know, pinched our noses. And this was an intentional use now. This wasn't necessarily somebody else, you know, pushing it towards me. I actually stole it out of the liquor cabinet and initiated. This time I got drunk and I got the euphoria and I remembered it. And, you know, the sensation of having that euphoria was initially very pleasant. And me and my friends had fun and so on and so forth. And then I began vomiting horribly. And I spent the rest of the night at my buddy's house across the street, you know, sick as a dog by his toilet. But I really latched on to that moment when I was feeling the euphoria and I felt okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember that sensation of feeling okay and feeling, you know, just that hole was diminished. So that was the first time that I really experienced the effects of it, and I got it. So that was about 9. Shortly thereafter, I just continued. It was fairly infrequent early on, you know, once a month or two, I don't remember exactly. But, and then I was introduced to marijuana at 10 years old, and now I could feel that sensation, and I didn't get sick. Alcohol made me sick, so I was always getting sick. Every time I drank, I'd get sick. And I really latched on to that at 10 years old, and of course I was doing this with my sister and her older friends, and we were stealing it from my mother. And so that year of turning 10 to 11 is when I became an addict, and I was using habitually, and I was experiencing, you know, the obsession and cravings, and it really became the centerpiece
So the people you hung out with were all deeply involved in the drug culture. And
absolutely.
In fact, at a young age, you aspired to be like them. I've heard you say that that's what you wanted to be. Did you ever consider there was another way to live?
No, and a lot of, you know, there's a lot of denial. I mean, it's a really cliche term associated with addictive behaviors. And, you know, yes, denial is a key component, not only from the addicts, but those that surround them, family members, and so on and so forth. However, in my case, in those early years, there wasn't really denial there per se, because I really didn't know any better. So it was more of an ignorant situation. It was very normal. I mean, everybody does it. That was my mindset. You know, my mother, my father, my sister, all my sister's friends, of course, and all my friends, because, you know, birds of a feather. So I hung out with, you know, people that were acting like I was acting. And so for many years, it was just normal. I mean, I thought everybody else was odd if they didn't act like I acted. And, you know, the denial came later when I, you know, gained more awareness and I got a little bit older and I realized what I was doing was really inappropriate. But at an early age, it was, you know, I was just kind of conditioned for that.
As the addiction progressed, did you ever feel like, I just can't do this anymore, I'm killing myself?
Yes. It really hit me when I was 16 and I got kicked out of high school. And then I got arrested for burglary of a habitation, which is basically breaking into a home and stealing. And I went to juvenile detention. And by that time, I was using crack cocaine along with methamphetamines and, you know, just about every drug under the sun. But I was severely addicted to crack cocaine by 16. And I went to juvenile detention, and it really hit me. And I swore I was going to change. And that's really at the point where I was starting to get it. The denial was starting to break down. And I ended up getting out of juvenile detention. And my parents didn't really, you know, there was no decisive action taken. My dad took me to some drug counselor and dropped me off and said, you know, go in and talk to these people and, you know, walk home.
Wow.
And so there wasn't support. And of course, I mean, I'm 16. I'm not, you know.
So were they angry at you, your parents? I mean, here they're doing this.
Oh, they were furious. They were furious. But the solution was to kick me out of the house. You know, so
they didn't get how their behavior was impacting you, though. They didn't see, okay, we're doing this, so.
Well, that's a part of the denial.
Yeah.
You know, if we acknowledge our behavior, that means that A, we have to acknowledge our behavior, and B, we may actually have to do something about it. So that's the denial component, and I was surrounded with that. So, and I don't think they were ready to change, and they were in denial and probably didn't want to deal with, you know, themselves and their own behaviors. I think also parents, and I know this being a parent, very hard to separate ourselves from our children and to not have somewhat of a codependent view. It's like, oh my gosh, if my kid's messed up, then that must mean I'm messed up and it's my fault. And that's the natural, you know, reaction. So I think a lot of times parents don't want to acknowledge what's going on in their kids or loved ones because of a kind of a codependent mentality, thinking it's their fault or something of that nature. So yeah, there's a lot of dynamics that went on. But ultimately, I got kicked out of the house, and I've been living on my own since I was 16.
So all of that just reaffirms the message. I mean, your dad dropping you off and saying, go in and talk to the counselor and walk home, not intervening, not showing that love and support, just reaffirms the message that I don't matter.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
Help our listeners understand, what drives a person to this level of self-destruction? Why was being you so painful? I mean, I get you felt a sense of not belonging, you were different, okay, the drugs provided, you know, the sense of euphoria, that was the hook. What else?
Well, at the bottom of it all is an avoidance of pain. And so I didn't want to be me. I didn't want to feel what I was feeling, and I had no coping skills. And so this was a way that I could check out. I could numb myself. I didn't have to be me. I didn't have to feel what I was feeling. I didn't have to cope. And so it became the tool for me to deal with all of that. And I had no other tools. So if I didn't have drugs and alcohol, I may have been a teen suicide. Who knows? I mean, what I was feeling and experiencing internally was so great that, you know, the drugs and alcohol at some level may have, you know, kept me from sticking a gun in my mouth. Mm. That's just how bad it was for me on the inside. And so then there's the piece, you know, so that's kind of the psychological piece. But then there's the physiological piece where, you know, and brain chemistry changes and, you know, all kinds of things are going on inside. But I craved it. I needed it. I obsessed over it. So, you know, my body wanted it. My mind wanted it. People that aren't, you know, addicted or never have been addicted to anything can't understand that sensation. And they're like, why don't you just quit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that have smoked cigarettes and have been addicted to nicotine have a glimpse into what it's like. You know, but that doesn't change your brain chemistry and there's not as many factors, but they have a glimpse into it. And I guess for people that are coffee drinkers, I mean, if you can think about it, if you're a serious coffee drinker, you wake up in the morning, you just can't think about it. I'm like, I got to get my first cup of coffee. You know, it almost like makes you normal to get your coffee in you. So take that and multiply it times 1,000. You know, that's the closest I can get to trying to paint a picture of what it's like for people that haven't experienced it. So there's a lot going on physiologically, psychologically, emotionally, all of those components, and it's kind of the perfect storm.
What finally flipped the switch for you, where you had that moment of clarity, as you called it?
Well, you know, I wish I could say I saw the light, but I felt the heat, and then I saw the light. You know, there has to come a place and time for everybody when, I mean, it's God's grace. Okay, first and foremost, it's God's grace. There has to come a time and place where the end of, you know, we have free will. And, you know, I don't, at least in my case, God didn't just strike me sober, you know. He gave me grace. He gave me space. And then obviously the strength to carry on. But there had to come a place in my physical world where the pain of what I was doing was greater than the perceived pain of change. That looks different for everybody. Some people it takes jail, some people it takes this, it takes that. Everybody has a different experience. But for me, what I was doing with the drugs and the alcohol and the lifestyle and jail and all the stuff that was going on was so incredibly painful that it became more painful than the idea of quitting. And so I got to that integral moment, and I also had a moment of truth and conviction where God showed me who and what I really was. And the denial was gone. For, you know, a very brief moment, I glimpsed into who and what I really was. And so with the denial gone, I saw that I was just, I mean, I was a scared, lonely, drug addict, criminal, felon. I would be dead or in jail in, you know, a matter of days, if not months. And, you know, I saw all that truth and all that reality. So that was definitely a gift that I was given to see that. And I just said, I just can't do it. I don't want to die, and I don't want to go to jail, and I just can't keep going any longer. And that's when I reached out for help. And it was March 17th of 1993.
Hmm. Powerful. Yeah, because so many people can't beat addiction in spite of all they know they'll lose. So you made it because, A, God kind of stepped in and gave you this kind of rhema moment, you know, of clarity, and the consequence piece just got so overwhelming for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely both. And, you know, I wish there was a simple, easy-to-explain linear formula for addiction and recovery because it would make everything so much easier, but it's not a simple linear you know, formula. Everybody has a different path, and the recovery path is different as well. So there's a lot of components to it, and it's not just perfectly cut and dry.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that it is perfectly cut and dry, and there's some non-negotiable in the recovery process. And, you know, it's mind, body, spirit. You cannot, you know, neglect any one of those components, which our modern mass media, you know, never really looks at, you know, God-centered recovery. And, you know, they just think it's all about therapy and, you know, changing your behavior and healing your body and yoga and whatever other, you know, pop culture stuff they're trying to throw out there. And at the core of all of this is the spiritual component, which is, you know, requires healing. And so that's part of my, that's my soapbox with mass media.
It's a great soapbox.
Yes, it is. So,
what don't people get about an addict, Eric?
You know, I think it's really what I talked about earlier, is that they just don't really understand just how powerful it is. So many people that don't have this experience, to them it just seems so logical. Well, you just quit. You know what I mean? You just quit. Well, you know, just stop hanging out with those people. You know, cut your hair, get a job, you know, whatever. And they don't really understand the depth of this illness. And so they want to go in and they want to slap Band-Aids on it. You know, when I told my parents, you know, I was homeless, I've been living in a car. I mean, it, you know, this is when I had my moment of clarity. I mean, it was bad. I'm sitting here telling them I'm dying and I need help. And their solution was cut your hair and get a job. But they just, a lot of people don't understand the depth of this.
Yeah. Thank you, Derek, for joining us. We're out of time for today. Join us next week to hear about the next chapter in Derek Steele's miraculous story, from addict to Christian to millionaire entrepreneur. Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.